Good afternoon and welcome to the Iowa City Formulations Council's program in collaboration with the Johnson County United Nations Association, featuring guest speaker Dr. David Swartney. Thanks to Dr. Swartney and to everyone who has joined us today in person and online. I am Catherine Whitnabin, Executive Director of the Iowa City Formulations Council. We would especially like to thank Jim Olson, who's actually here with us, and the Johnson County United Nations Association for their continuing support and great partnership. We like doing these programs with them every October in honor of United Nations Day, and this is a great partnership, and we're very grateful to them. We also want to thank and acknowledge our annual donors, members, sponsors, and other people for their continuing support and great partnership. This includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, and City Channel 4, and especially Lily, who's here today with us helping to live stream this, for providing online access to our programs along with the University of Iowa Library Archives. We want to point out that ICFRC has adopted the Native American Land Acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Human Rights Commission. We recognize that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homelands of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. The full text of our acknowledgement is on our website at icfrc.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Barbara Eckstein, who will introduce our speaker and will serve as moderator for this program. Dr. Eckstein is the Vice President of Johnson County United Nations Association, and she retired from the University of Iowa in 2019, where she was Professor of English. She was also on the faculty of the University of Iowa Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research and a Professor in International Programs. Dr. Eckstein.
Thank you, Catherine. As Catherine said, the Johnson County United Nations Association partners with the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council to do this event every year, and we're very pleased to do it. It commemorates the United Nations Day, which was in fact Monday, October 24th, and that date marked the 77th anniversary of the institution of the UN Charter. Since 2015, the mission of the UN Charter has been articulated as 17 sustainable development goals on which nations, non-governmental organizations, businesses, local governments, and individuals are urged to act now in anticipation of targets set for 2030. Every year, you might like to know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation publishes a report assessing progress made towards these targets connected to the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, as they're frequently called. JCUNA has put the SDGs at the core of our action and advocacy. We are committed to learning more and doing more to advance these 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals that address poverty, peace, climate change, clean water, and more. Today, Dave Swartney, William D. Ashton Professor of Civil Engineering at the University of Iowa, the Director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination, and the Director of the Environmental Research Program for the UI Public Policy Center, will explain how the SDGs are being used as the basis for a new curriculum at the University of Iowa. I know and admire Dave not only as an environmental engineer, but also as a person who understands the values of the humanities and the importance of public and political engagement. It's a pleasure to welcome him here today.
Wow, so that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Jim, for the invitation to be here. I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you about the new degree program. So I want to do a few things with this presentation. I want to quickly overview the SDGs just to make sure that we're sort of familiar with the history of where they've come from. I want to tell you a bit about our program specifically, and then I want to give you a bit of an idea of what it means to train students to be leaders in sustainability and some of the unique opportunities in education that come from using the SDGs as a framework. And so I guess off we go. The question is probably to start with is, you know, why did we want to develop a graduate program around the SDGs? And me and a few of my colleagues that I'll introduce in a bit really feel that they're an ideal framework to train students who want to use their education to make a difference. There is this shift in terms of students that are seeking out particularly research and more sort of experiential learning opportunities where they want to feel like they can use their education to sort of tie it to social goods. There's social justice as a strong driver, particularly for broadening participation and really increasing the number of people that are pursuing education and unique training opportunities. And we really think that the SDGs sort of embody what we could be trying to build a new generation of students around, sort of understanding the strengths of them. We'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges, maybe even some of the flaws that could be embedded into them, but making folks aware so that as we think about a roadmap to sustainability in 2030, or whether it's the Paris goals in 2050 and beyond, you know, are we really doing all that we can to make sure students, as they leave something like the University of Iowa, know how they can make an impact, make a difference, and use their expertise in that way. And so maybe this review isn't needed, but given that there's a variety of folks that could be watching online or in the room, making sure that we sort of understand where the SDGs came from, and there were actually goals before this, right? And so at the turn of the new millennium, world leaders gathered at the UN, and they were really focused on poverty as the driving force, and that's what led to the development of the Millennium Development Goals. And so these were set in basically as the leading development framework for the globe from 2000 to 2015. And you can look at the goals there for the MDGs and where their focus was. And definitely ensure environmental sustainability was one of them. But there were other, you know, focus with related to poverty and hunger, primary education, gender equality, child mortality, maternal health, HIV/AIDS, and then global partnerships to promote development. And so this was really, at the time, pretty foundational and monumental. It was this pledge to uphold the principles of human dignity, equality, and equity, and really with the intent of trying to free the world from poverty. And so the question you might ask after, with once that was done in 2000, since this is now our history to 2015, is, well, did they work? And while you could parse it out, and I'm sure there were some goals and targets that may not have been fully achieved, that there is a healthy amount of evidence that these did quite a great deal of good. I won't read these to you. You can look through them, but there are improvements that touch on each of those goals that were set. And some of them are pretty astounding, right? You know, maternal mortality declined 45% worldwide, with most of the reductions occurring since 2000. And so these commitments of the MDGs started to really give people purpose and motivation. And so, you know, maybe that's a great thing to think about. Once we've had these Millennium Development Goals, they've been completed, what did we learn from them? And it has been characterized by the UN as the most successful anti-poverty movement in history. But probably more importantly, it set a pretty clear example for the value of setting goals. That if you had goals that were set, targeted interventions, if you associated those with sound strategies, that there was, any, you know, importantly, resources and political will. There was the opportunity to really drive large-scale global change, even for the poorest of countries, to make progress. And it was really the success of the MDGs that led to the new framework, which is the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, that were adopted in 2015. And so these are the 17 Sustainable Development Goals that Barbara had mentioned. They're a little bit more diverse, right? Whereas poverty was really the driving focus of the MDGs, we see that we've expanded now to these 17 goals. Poverty is still central. It's SDG number one. There's some similarities with zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth, industry innovation and infrastructure, reduced inequalities, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, climate action, life below water, life on land, peace, justice, and strong institutions, and partnerships for the goals. You can break these down, and it's sometimes done in this way, that there are these five elements that are really underpinning those 17 SDGs: people, planet, prosperity, peace and justice, and partnerships. And that these goals were meant to stimulate that same level of action that the MDGs did over the next 15 years, and we're now down to eight with 2030 as our target, in these five critical areas of importance. So this includes our seven people goals, so that's 1 through 7, and I won't read them again since I just read them all. The five prosperity goals, these are the ones that are in trying to ensure prosperous and fulfilling lives in harmony with nature. The three planet goals, protect our planet's natural resources and climate for future generations. The peace and justice goal, which is 16, foster peaceful, just, and inclusive societies. And then the partnership goal, implement the agenda through a solid global partnership. And that's 17. If you're familiar with the SDGs, you'll also know that for each of these 17 goals, there are follow-up targets, and so essentially sub-goals, if you want to think of them that way. I just pulled the ones for clean water and sanitation. I realize the font is small. I don't expect you to read those all. But within these targets, there's also indicators. What are measurable, ideally measurable quantities that can be used to assess our progress towards these? And so this one up top, a good example of an indicator, percentage of the population using safely managed drinking water resources. So that this was a very deliberate approach or framework where the intent was to think about, okay, if this is the goal that we want to achieve, what are the targets that we should be shooting for in a fairly broad area like clean water and sanitation? And then what are specific things we should be looking for to know that we're making progress? Overall, there's 232 indicators for each of those 17 goals. And if you're not familiar with the site Our World in Data, it's definitely worth checking out. They focus on data visualizations, particularly large, complex data sets, and this might fall into it with the 232 indicators. And this is really just looking at what data is available. Now, I will acknowledge that when they produced their indicators, that there were several tiers to indicators, and some of which were acknowledged that they didn't necessarily have the right metrics in mind at the time, or that we might not have access to all of that data. And that's what this visualization is showing. If it's in green, these are where there are indicators that are available. Yellow, there are official metrics, but we may not have comprehensive data. Ones in red are indicators for which, to the best of the knowledge of the authors here, that global monitoring is not currently possible. So when we think about, are we making progress towards the SDGs, we need to be understanding that there are some of the indicators and targets that we've set that we are still wrestling with the right way to get the information to know if we're making progress. So and with that framework in mind, this is what motivated me and my colleagues to think about how can we use this in education. And so some of the questions that we thought about at the time is, does the siloed nature of graduate education, since this is a master's degree, support working towards the SDGs? I think about this a lot. My home discipline is engineering. I'm now also in chemistry, but definitely from the sciences and engineering. And when you see something like SDG 16, which is the one that's about sort of peace and justice and equity, where are we teaching our engineers and our scientists to understand those concepts and how they can integrate it into the work that they do as their core expertise? The traditional silos, the traditional frameworks for education just don't allow for that, but it should. We should create space for it. And so can we better train graduate students to see how their expertise fits into the integrated network of the SDGs? And I believe that we can. I believe that we can at least make them aware of the SDGs and understand how those can be operationalized and localized, but going into it with open eyes, where again, I want to talk a little bit towards the end, that I know there are critics of the SDGs and some of the things that we could be sort of embedding in terms of how we view what progress looks like in certain parts of the world. So we need to be, we need to acknowledge that. And then, how do we train our students to recognize value and leverage the interconnectedness? We'll talk a lot about how many of these goals are linked together. Some directly influence other ones. Some are kind of both a means and an ends to the others, right? If you generate equitable and peace and non-corrupt institutions, you're likely to hopefully have solved issues like clean water and sanitation, because people will understand if we're just and equitable in our institutions that we need to make sure we provide that for everyone. And as I was explaining to Jim and Barbara earlier, what's really nice is that the sustainability as a discipline, I think, is really not just sort of gathering its legs, but it's also running now. There's healthy literature out there on what it really means to educate in sustainability. And some of the leading authors in this area that have talked about the need to develop these types of training programs, you know, speak to the need for large-scale educational transformation, that we need to equip a new generation of professionals, and not just sustainability professionals, to address these sustainability challenges. And some of the things we might need to emphasize, problem-solving approaches that integrate systems thinking, structured anticipation, value-laden deliberation, evidence-supported strategies, and strong collaboration across government, businesses, and civil society. So there are roadmaps on how we can do this, not just for sustainability professionals. And so this was really the motivation for the program that we created that I want to tell you just a little bit about and then give you a sense of some of the things that we do to educate in this program. This is some of our marketing materials. We're still trying to raise awareness of this program. We have our first cohort that started this fall. It is 5 outstanding students. We do want to see that grow. So if you're aware of folks that might be interested, please direct them my way. And I want to acknowledge my partners in this process. We came together across colleges, Dave Bennett in Geographical and Sustainability Sciences, Lucy Lorien from our School of Planning and Public Affairs, my colleague Michelle Scherer in Civil and Environmental Engineering, and myself. It is very difficult to do anything across college at the University of Iowa. Interdisciplinarity is something that we like to talk about, is something we value, but we really don't put structures in place to support it and allow it to grow and thrive. We intentionally created this program in the graduate college, which serves all of the other colleges at the university, and that was intentional to make sure that we could pull students from every which way. I absolutely believe there is a place for humanities and the arts and social scientists when it comes to these issues, right? And I want to make sure we created a home for them. If we did this in engineering, I felt we would have a very one-sided view of sustainability. We needed to think more collaboratively across campus. So this is our website. You can check us out if you're interested, sdg.grad.uiowa.edu. And real briefly, you know, what the students do, it's a one-year training program for a master's degree. And it's coursework intensive, and so the students come in and take 5 core courses, some of which we've developed specifically for this program. Then we have them take 2 courses that are tied to particular skills or analytical methods and other skills that they'll need to work in this space. And then we encourage them to take clustered electives around one of the SDGs where they'd like to make a difference, right? So if someone comes in and wants to do something on the sustainable cities, we do actually have, through our urban and regional planning program, really outstanding courses geared towards, well, what does it mean to build cities in a way that are more sustainable? And we can get them a cluster of expertise there. These are the courses that the students take. We have an overview course that's taught by Dave Bennett where he walks through each of the SDGs and you look at recent literature. We think it's really important that we use the framework and we make students aware of what each of these goals represents, the targets, the indicators, the science behind it, the research and work that's being done. I teach a class that's called Building Future Leaders in Sustainable Development. I will tell you a little bit more about it at the end, but the point of that class is there's a lot of skills that we need that aren't traditional to any discipline, really. So we use this as an opportunity to cover things like team science, like how do you actually work in a productive collaboration? I've had the opportunity, and I'll show you some slides in a bit, where we actually weave in concepts like emotional intelligence as it relates to leadership and the need to be self-aware. All of this is viewed as very critical to not just being effective at performing in sort of complex systems working towards problems, but to lead in these areas, which we're hoping to produce. We have a emphasis on communication, where it's a co-taught course on communicating data through stories. So there's a strong emphasis on being able to talk and speak on these issues to diverse audiences, particularly across differences and where people might feel well, you know, these can be some controversial topics in some spots, and so we have to make sure that we understand how to dialogue in a productive way. And then this is a project-based class called the Sustainable Communities Lab, where our students will work with communities through the Urban and Regional Planning Program and the Iowa Initiative for Sustainable Communities to actually do project-based implementation in the field. And so, for example, for the Sustainable Communities Lab, Our students are currently working with the city of Clinton on a couple different projects and thinking about them from the context of the SDGs where possible, but getting a chance to really develop interpersonal skills, working with communities, working with cities, diverse clients and perspectives, and trying to sort of find consensus in designing better, more sustainable solutions, ideally. This is we do have a thesis option. I just want to make folks aware of it. So in the first year, the students primarily take those courses. In the second year, we're looking for various forms of financial support to support students to work on project-based theses and partnerships with communities, with other organizations. And so this is something that's active where we're sort of in a fundraising mode, as everyone probably seems to be, to make sure that we can actually give students some really good focused experiential learning in the form of a project-based thesis. We've done some examples of this, some pilots with support from the Graduate College, where, for instance, we had a master student that worked with the city of Iowa City looking at their stormwater management infrastructure. I think there's some opportunities, if you can make the financials work out, to have students from this program work locally here in Iowa, as a lot of communities are thinking about what do we need to do to be more sustainable, to address climate change, to sort of move in line with what the SDGs are trying to aspire to transform society by. So, and this was again articulated in some of the sustainability literature, but I think it's a good guidepost for us. Our goals then are to produce students that can address complex anthropogenic challenges with a variety of research and teaching approaches that are problem-driven and solution-oriented. We need to produce students that generates, integrates, and links use-inspired knowledge to transformational action in participatory, deliberative, and adaptive settings. And really, I mean, this should be something that we don't just try to aspire for our SDG students, but we need future problem solvers, change agents, and perhaps more importantly in a changing climate, transition managers. This one is particularly pertinent to my field in engineering, where I call home. I emphasize all the time that we design engineered solutions based off a past climate that no longer exists, right? And we need assumptions to make effective designs, and our assumptions are now shrouded in uncertainty with climate change. So how do we actually build a sustainable society when the climate that we will be confronting is something that we have a bit of an uncertainty on, depending on how we act and how we change and how responsive we as a society is? We're going to need to produce a new generation of students that understands that and can be adaptive, deliberative, participatory to figure out the right ways forward. So how exactly do we do that? And so I thought it might be helpful for this crowd to talk about, what does it actually mean to be a sustainability professional or be trained in the sustainability sciences? And there's some great frameworks that we can use, and hopefully some of the skills that we're trying to impart on our students will resonate with this crowd as you think about how we sit today, thinking about where our society is going through the SDGs and with climate change, et cetera. And so this framework is from the sustainability education literature, and I think it makes perfect sense. We currently sit here where basically the present day we should see as a complex problem constellation. They're complex problem constellations in the current situation in their history. We are living as a part of a complex system, highly interconnected. Actions in one sphere can influence another. There's certainly history and context that has gotten us here. And we need to produce students that can understand that system, the system in which they live today, not just sort of in an analytical sense, but also our norms and our values. So at some point in the future, there could be an intervention, and we need to train students that can sort of have this type of anticipatory judgment as to where we're going. Ideally, we want to have visions for what sustainability looks like. What is a more sustainable society? Again, what are the norms and values that we use to determine what that looks like? At the same time, we need to be able to contrast that with what happens if we do nothing. Like, what are our non-intervention scenarios? That is our future baseline. And appreciating this difference is important to motivating change and motivating action. And then most importantly, how do we develop effective transition strategies? How do we get from where we are to where we need to go? And how do we make that process as needed iterative, where we need to get feedback and respond and keep working at it? Because often there aren't clean-cut solutions. There's only better or worse options. And so these are the competencies that have been defined for someone who's working in sustainability. This is how we would articulate those skills. We need someone with what's known as systems thinking competence to understand that we are living in a complex system, and we're, as we solve these attempt to solve these problems, we need to understand their connections to other interrelated problems. We need this anticipatory competence, or what is sometimes referred to as future thinking's competence. How do we visualize what the future looks like, that sustainability vision? How do we formulate that so we know what we're pushing society towards? We need normative competence, again, or the values thinking competence. What are society's values and norms of which we make decisions? How are we deciding what's better or worse, right or wrong? Because we have to make some of those decisions for the future when we think about sustainability. Strategic competence, how do we actually get it done? We need strategic thinking, action-oriented. We need to produce people who know best practices to bring diverse groups together and actually drive change. And that's that part of interpersonal competence. They need to be able to collaborate. We tell our students all the time, these are complex problems, no one discipline is going to solve it. We can't assume that students will immediately know how to work on complex teams, how they'll need to understand and appreciate different disciplines. If we don't give them some training on how to do that appropriately, we're setting them up to fail when they end up in a diverse, highly collaborative environment working on a complex grand challenge for society. These map onto that framework. You can see that here you need systems thinking to be able to fully evaluate where we currently sit. You need the anticipatory competence to understand what those non-intervention and potential sustainability visions look like. You need values and norms to help define what is better and what is worse. What's wrong about today? What could be better about tomorrow? And you need that strategic competence to figure out how do we actually drive transitions and change. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we can define these a little bit more openly then, right? That's this idea of systems thinking competence. To be able to collectively analyze complex systems across different domains, society, environment, economy, across different scales from local to global, even through time. And then concepts that are really critical when we think of things like climate change, cascading effects, inertia, feedback loops, unintended consequences. Those are things we have to get students thinking about. On the anticipatory competence, we need to be able to generate students that have the ability to analyze, evaluate, and craft these rich pictures of what a future related to sustainability looks like. And what are some sustainability problem-solving frameworks that have that sort of future-oriented knowledge? For normative competence, the ability to collectively map, specify, apply, reconcile, negotiate values, principles, goals, and targets. And this is going to be critical for us first identifying what is not great about where we sit today. You know, to know what is sustainable, you need to be able to define what is unsustainable. And with that comes things like societal values, our principles, our goals. This is a tricky one, right? Because these will vary. There are some folks that will argue over what our values should be and what we should prioritize going forward. We need to create students that are comfortable operating in that space and talking, having those conversations. And very much so, a huge underlying concept in the SDGs is intergenerational equity. We have to believe there's value for people that we don't yet know, that aren't yet on this earth, and we need to be motivated to act for them. Justice, equity, the connections between social and ecological systems and maintaining their integrity and ethics. So to pause here, this is, again, I think we should be training every student in these concepts. And sometimes we don't get that opportunity. We get wrapped up in what degrees need, what requirements we need for certain degrees in the traditional ways in which we educate. But again, from my area of the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, we should be making sure we're producing students that understand justice, equity, ethics. Otherwise, we're just putting folks out into the world. They're going to continue to propagate things that we've screwed up already, to put it bluntly. Strategic competence. You know, how are you effective in really driving transitions and transformation? And really, this is just the skills of how you get things done. We all know people who are really effective at getting things done. We want those people in charge of pushing society forward. I think we can at least get students understanding, you know, how do we develop that can-do type of attitude. There are tools that allow, you know, there are best practices. Some of this is pulled from the management literature, I'll be perfectly honest, when it comes to things like business. But we kind of know what traits we need in effective leaders that can bring people together. Communication is a foundational piece here, right? If you can't talk across disciplines to different people, you're not going to be able to rally the diverse populations to sort of bring folks together in a complex system and drive change. And that's the interpersonal confidence. You got to be able to communicate, deliberate, negotiate, collaborate, have empathy. A lot of this came from a training program we got money from the NSF to implement that we just did in engineering. And at the end of the day, I kept saying, all I really want to do is produce empathetic engineers. Like, I want to make sure that we produce students that can go out and actually listen to people, not assume we know the right answer, listen and work with folks to understand what the solutions are, and then work with them in a way to drive towards that. And that can be kind of counter to how we actually sometimes do things, and we certainly need to take every opportunity to tell our students to do that when they have the chance. I won't bore you with this, but for those of you that are into the education piece here, there's a lot of great literature that makes these actionable and tangible. You might be wondering, okay, well, what does it mean? Well, here are some concepts, some methodologies to support those, some reading you can do in the space. This is just the one for systems thinking competence. You can dig into the literature more, and there's actually checklists. If you are if you're at a novice level, here are the skills you should have when it comes to systems thinking. Here's your intermediate level. Here's your advanced level. That there are frameworks out there that we can build training programs around that make things that sometimes feel a little nebulous much more concrete. Here are things that we can train you to be better at doing. And here are the benchmarks in the road to know that you're getting there. So with the last, like, maybe 15 minutes or so here, I want to talk a little bit about my class, because it gives you, like I said, one of the things I wanted to share with you is some of the unique opportunities that using the SDGs as a framework gives you a chance to build educational concepts around. What we teach, or what I teach in this class, we talk about team science and collaboration, trying to give people the skills to understand what it means to be effective on a diverse team. Everybody has heard diversity makes teams perform better. But why and how do you cultivate that in a productive way? Like, you need to be deliberate about that, else those differences can actually divide teams, right? Working with communities, that's the idea of transdisciplinarity and co-production. We can do that better. We can train students how to do that, particularly in the framework of the SDGs, to drive local action. Ethics, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Systems thinking, we do a lot of reading from the literature on actual application, sustainability, and practice. And I think even more importantly, even though it's like a sub-theme, career exploration. We've got to show these students that there are people out there that have jobs that they want, that are valued in the communities, that are working as sustainability coordinators at businesses, on campuses, in cities, and beyond. Federal, local, they're there. So, you know, why team science? I mean, team science is this basic understanding that, you know, there's definitely managing what we think and what we know, like, on a team. That's our knowledge, and making sure that you appreciate differences in knowledge. But equally important is the people. You have to be able to work with people. And so that there's these two phases of working on a very collaborative, interdisciplinary team or cross-disciplinary. You need to be able to manage the people and essentially like the expertise piece. And that's going to influence management, dynamics, and communication. And all of those are critical parts of team success. So again, we tell students all the time, you have to work on we're going to need diverse teams to solve these problems. And the reason is because how many of you have heard of the term wicked problems? What we're trying to do is get our students working on what are referred to in the literature as wicked problems. And wicked problems are defined. I don't expect you to read all of this, but there has been a lot of great literature that lays out the characteristics of what a wicked problem is. I want to focus on this one here. Wicked problems do not have true-false solutions, rather good, bad, or better, worse ones. You know, you don't really solve a wicked problem. You just find a variety of outcomes, and you have to determine which ones are better and which one is worse. And so these end up being rather complicated, And the only way you can do this in sort of an equitable, just, and effective way is making sure you're working with a variety of disciplines, bringing in people, different voices, and figuring out paths forward. So there's a lot of good work out there on the types of skills that are needed to work on effective teams. This is from one of the guides that we use. It's things like talking intentionally about trust, vision, self-awareness, and emotional intelligence, leadership, mentoring, team evolution and dynamics, communication, how you recognize and share success, conflict and disagreement, navigating and leveraging networks and systems. I would say these are skills that all of our students need, particularly if you're going to work on wicked problems with diverse partners. And then you see things. You might be wondering, well, what does something like emotional intelligence have to do with the SDGs? Even the United Nations acknowledges that we need emotional intelligence, which is being self-aware, recognizing, understanding, and managing one's emotion, and equally important, recognizing and responding appropriately to the feelings of others. The UN has hosted events on the power of emotional intelligence when it comes to achieving the SDGs. And in particular, they've done this in the context of SDG 16, peace, justice, and strong institutions. If you read the promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development, access to justice for all, and build effective, accountable, and inclusive institutions at all levels, what are the skills students need to be able to do that, right? That's far beyond what they might teach in a traditional textbook. And then it gets even more daunting if you look at some of the sub-targets that relate to things like violence and war and a variety of other things in terms of human trafficking and making sure that students understand the complexities of what it means to have peace and justice and strong institutions. So this is one of those ones where I talked about it's what's known as a cross-cutting goal. It's both a means and an end to achieve all the other SDGs. That peaceful and inclusive societies are both outcomes and enablers of sustainable development. So this is a critical one. But the key here is realizing that we're not really going to get this idea of peaceful and inclusive societies until we really challenge change in what is referred to, what the UN will talk about as the inner dimension of individuals and the actors in the sustainable development goals. There's been lots of great literature on the power of using emotional intelligence towards supporting peaceful, just, and inclusive societies. And you can make some very strong links between someone who has high emotional intelligence, which is, you know, it's, you can think of it as an analog to IQ, your intellectual quotient, intelligent quotient, towards the ability to recognize your own emotions, discern different feelings. These all end up being really critical to adopting new paradigms and really enabling transformation towards sustainability, conflict resolution, peace building. These are things that you need emotionally intelligent folks to work on to drive society towards SDG 16. We talk about transdisciplinarity. So transdisciplinarity, if you're not familiar, I'll talk about it a bit on the next slide. It's actually working not just with other academic disciplines, but with social actors. So it's beyond inter or cross-disciplinary because you are actually now bringing in social actors that are not from the academic or professional sphere, and that we recognize that there's the need to have transdisciplinarity and innovation in the transdisciplinary space to drive the SDGs at a local scale. So there's, in the literature, some characterizations and some characteristics of what transdisciplinary research is about. The third one here is the big one, the involvement of non-academic, and you could say more generally non-professional, right? Because these can happen in the business world or in industry. Non-academic societal actors as process participants. It's actually doing something highly integrated with essentially a community, end users, that have as much stake in it as the people who are out with the quote unquote the expertise of how to get this done. This is where the idea of things like co-production, co-creation, co-generation come from. It's sometimes referred to as co-ex processes. For co-production, co-creation, co-generation, we're involving non-academic actors as full partners from production, for the production of new knowledge. It's even using the community, the social actors, in the idea of formulating the problem. It's not assuming that we know what the answer is, but it's going out and very deliberately hearing what the concerns of those social actors are and working with them to identify the right paths forward. And I, you know, ironically, everyone acknowledges it's very rare as opposed to a more superficial engagement. No knock on community engagement activities, but those can tend to be very unidirectional, where someone with an expertise goes out and says, I'm going to help this group with what I know. That's entirely different from what this is. This is, let's work together to collaboratively build towards solutions, where everybody sees each other as equals. What I like about that paper that I shared is it does a really great job of talking about what it means to take the SDGs and apply them at a local level. That there's a lot in the literature about how at a local scale, communities, very diverse and heterogeneous, lots of different, you know, particularly motives and end goals that people might be trying to achieve. How do you actually operationalize something as big as and global as the SDGs at a local scale? And this paper was trying to use transdisciplinarity as a way to do this, is that you can actually work in a productive way to have joint framing of local goals and actions, that essentially you can work collaboratively to identify what should be the goals that we're trying to achieve through these actions. And those local goals and actions would come out through deliberation between both the social actors and sort of the expertise, if you will. The next is an uncertainty analysis, like evaluating those critical uncertainties. What are the vulnerabilities that are coming down the road? And then finally, co-creating adaptive pathways. How do we together create pathways that push us towards sustainability? And so this is a little small, and I'm struggling to read it on the way this is presented here. I'll see if I can blow it up. But these three underlying questions, you know, what are localized goals and actions for achieving sustainability? How does uncertainty impact the efficacy of actions in attaining these goals? And how to successfully implement actions and achieve localized goals under that uncertainty? That there are questions we can ask to work with groups together, collectively and collaboratively, to figure out paths forward. Another thing that we touch on is design thinking. This is a concept that's gaining some popularity, particularly at U.S. funding agencies that want to start funding design thinking or use-inspired research. And again, the UN has talked about this recently as being an important tool to realizing the Sustainable Development Goals. If you're not familiar with the concept of design thinking or use-inspired research, it's actually essentially a framework to working on problems where you actually start by just learning from your audience. You don't actually assume that you have the solution. You go and you empathize with the end user and you try to figure out, you learn, you know, who is my user? What matters to this person? What problems do they have that I think that we can solve? You then sort of analyze that, you know, this could be as simple as some interviews, just community groups where you listen, and then you analyze that information to think about what are the needs. Then you sort of create possible solutions, you build some sort of rough prototype, and you sort of let people validate it, what worked, what didn't, and then you iterate, right? So this is actually the reason it's called like use-inspired research or design thinking, is that you're actually letting the people who need to benefit from whatever the end product, goods, or service is, you're letting them define what are the key characteristics that are needed. You know, this has a spot when you think about SDG 12, responsible consumption and production. What is a sustainable product? People are driven to buy things that are more sustainable. But is it truly? And there's some really compelling arguments out there that if we use things like design thinking, where we're actively engaging with end users, that we can design products that are more in line with something that is truly sustainable, that accounts for changes in human behavior. There's lots of instances where people have designed something that they think is sustainable, but people just use it in an unexpected way, and then it actually might just be more of a hindrance. Citizen science, another great way that we can get people involved locally, and we can train students how to do this and think about citizen science. There's been some really outstanding perspectives about the need to use citizen science to help us understand what progress we're making towards the SDGs. This is a pretty complicated graph, but it's all of the SDGs here. But the point I'm going to make is these are all those indicators, right? All 232 again. The ones in green are where we are currently using citizen science to help people understand if we're making progress. The authors identified all the ones in yellow where we could use citizen science. Remember, what citizen science is working with essentially citizens in communities on the ground to collect information in a very research-oriented way. And it is a fantastic way to collect data if we need indicators for how much progress we're making. And we're lacking that data. We need to be figuring out how to engage people to help us understand our progress. And there is a lot of untapped potential here if we can make folks aware that we should be using something like citizen science to help fill those gaps. And then, why teach ethics and diversity? It's because there's been a lot of fair criticism of the SDGs. That if you look at where progress is being made currently, it's being made in more developed countries with resources, and we are not making as much progress in the developing world. And then there's issues about, when we define some of these metrics and indicators of where we're going, have we defined them in a very equitable and sort of inclusive way? And so this is one on sanitation and some of the indicators and targets for sanitation, and is diversity missing? And so when you think about clean water and sanitation and women and the need to different needs in different parts of the world, we need to make sure that we're being as inclusive as possible. There's been folks that have criticized, some of these development activities essentially being tied closely just a new form of colonialism, that we're leading with a business perspective and trying to pull developing countries up through economic means that might not be the best way for them and might have ulterior motives for the folks that are trying to make profit off of that new business, right? And so thinking about these issues in the framework and understanding that there could be some potential challenges there. And then finally, systems thinking. In fact, many of the targets and goals are interconnected, and you can find all of these great systems diagrams online that do things like try to show people where goal 17 ties to goal 9, and is it a positive connection? Is it a reinforcing positive connection, or is it one that might actually have a negative effect? We need to make sure that our students can understand concepts of how to at least read something like this, understand it, see the interconnectivity, and move from there. So with that, I figured I'd end, here. Just once again, the need, large-scale educational transformation. I do believe in that. This is a new program. I don't think we're going to get it right from day one, but we are at least trying to tackle some of these new ideas and integrate in some new training models. And with that, I would happily take any questions you all have. That's my information. You're welcome to email me, call, check out the website, or you can follow me on Twitter. Thank you so much for your attention, both here in the room and online, and I look forward to some dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. So I'm going to try to monitor what I'm sure will be an active set of questions. And I will bring you the microphone if you're here, but if you're online, please text your question to 2588. Let me say that again the correct way. 319-600-2588. Okay, so questions in the room? I'll hold it for you.
So I think you said you had five students.
Correct.
In this new, what's their background? Where do they come from?
Ah, excellent. And you're gonna put me on the spot. So they come from diverse backgrounds. Comes from an environmental engineering background, did his undergraduate here at the University of Iowa. The other, she did her undergraduate at the University of Iowa in computer science. We have someone who's come to us with business and the classics as their background. So classics as their undergrad and then business analytics for a graduate program degree. Another that's coming with I want to say marketing and then a minor in environmental science. And then someone who is on sort of, it's kind of like the engineering sciences, engineering management background that actually plays for the UI football team. Graduate transfer tight end that is eager to, Yeah, so it is a diverse group, and that's what we wanted. We wanted interdisciplinarity. I think it makes the classroom fun. They bring different perspectives. They challenge me, which is great. You know, I think it's important to have classrooms where, in lecture halls, where there's a lot of back and forth, and you know, you make space to share perspectives. So it's been fun, and we want to grow it.
Thank you so much for an excellent presentation. I wish I was younger, because this would be a program that I would love to have done.
Thank you.
We have a question online asking if you talk more about you talked at the beginning about storytelling and data.
Ooh.
So they'd like to know more about that.
Yeah, that's actually really, I'm trying to remember which context I mentioned it. So there's a big push, and we have, I think, some great leadership in it here at the university as the writing university, on the power of narrative and storytelling, particularly on complex issues in you know, of environment and place and space. And so, in fact, I'm part of a new grant. It's through the NSF, and we're going to be using sort of a combination of data visualizations and stories and compelling narratives to try to raise awareness and sort of empower action on nutrient pollution. And in fact, one of the students that came with a computer science background, she's ideally suited to help us on some of that data integration, and so she'll be working on that project with us, which is really cool. And so I think there's a huge opportunity to use the power of storytelling and narratives to get people to understand how they relate to a lot of these issues and how it could affect them, and also inspire folks that there's opportunities for, you know, this person's sort of found their way to drive change. So we're doing that, like I said, in the context of nutrient pollution, but I think there's a huge opportunity to do it beyond that. And there's some great work at the university of people who are trying to do that type of work. Eric Adal is a colleague of ours who's involved with that grant, and he's a professor in English. And I love that there's that opportunity to think about how we can kind of, you know, what NSF refers to this as is convergence. We're sort of bringing different perspectives and different disciplines together to try to kind of create new knowledge, and I think that's a great way where we can weave data and stories together to do that.
Yeah, thanks for your talk. I had actually two questions.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there were other models of graduate education in the U.S. or the Big Ten that looked at sustainability that inspired you or that you drew upon to create this program. And also just wondering about pushback, especially climate denial or people who might suggest that there aren't any real problems that we need to be looking at.
Yeah, great questions. So there are models of other programs around. Arizona State has a really great several educational programs and a master's degree, including that in sustainability. I can't get all the details right. Michigan's got a great emphasis in sustainability. We felt we were still going to be fairly unique with our one-year SDG-centered one, so we might be the only ones that go as far as to talk about sustainable development and build the framework around the SDGs, but we're definitely not the first to do sort of sustainability curriculum. And I'd be remiss to not mention that Dave Bennett, who's doing this with us, started a sustainability sciences undergrad that's been showing a lot of popularity here at the university. It's been growing, and we also have, for some time, have had a sustainability certificate where students can take clusters of classes as an undergrad to sort of show they have some specialization in sustainability. We really wanted to create this program at least to give some of those students a home if they wanted to stay and pursue and get additional training. So there are others, and we looked at them, but we still felt like we had some opportunities to be distinct. On the second one, yeah, this is a really tough question because, you know, I'm all about saying that we need to talk frankly about, you know, climate change is the terminology we need to use, because I think we diminish it if we don't use it, right? I think we undercut all the people who are working and have worked to show that climate change is real and we're causing it if we try to dance around it and call it extreme weather or other things, right? So I think it does matter how we name it. That being said, I'd be remiss to not acknowledge that I think there's more exceptions to something like sustainability, which climate can fit into, than naming it like, you know, we weren't going to create a climate change program. And in part because we didn't want to. Like, we wanted to create something that was broader. What I love about this framework, and I mentioned the need for interdisciplinarity and you got to get different groups together, I'd like to think just about every major in college on the university campus could fit into this. And if we're truly, really trying to think about breaking down silos and breaking down barriers and getting people together from different disciplines to really create new knowledge and drive real change, you know, maybe folks don't see how they fit into climate. I think many would look at this and say, I could see where my expertise might contribute.
I'm sorry I came late.
It's quite all right.
thank you so much for your presentation. I'm not a student anymore, but I'm just you. By hearing you speak, I just got excited. I'm like, well, how do I do to take this, you know, class or this program? Just as a leader, there's so many leaders right now. I know this is for students, future leaders, or future people that want to help the community. But right now, there are leaders that need to help the community. And every meetings that I went to, I hear leaders say, we need to go listen. But how about do a strategy planning for people, leaders, to actually even just come and just listen to this and, you know, see themselves what they can do, because it's very much for me needed for them to know and understand what they're working on right now.
That's great. Yeah. We'll take people into the program at any stage, obviously. We've had one of the groups we really want to try to build out is working professionals who want to pick up greater familiarity with sustainability concepts. And there's a few different models in which we can do that. You know, we are getting inquiries about people wanting to take it part-time, and I think we can accommodate that. We're trying to do things to build classes that are all taught in the afternoon or at hours that might be a little bit easier for people to step away from work for. And there is no fixed time frame, so it's a one-year degree if you want it to be. You can take the classes as they go. We're in the process, and it's a little slower than it should be, of making like a certificate where you can take a cluster of courses and not have to commit to a full 10, but maybe get some of our core ones, so that, again, having like a graduate certificate with some specialization. And there's ways in which, if you can work within the institution, to have those types of things be tied to working professionals, so it's a little bit more, I don't know, economical and accessible. I mean, the real unfortunate part about all this is it costs money. And finding a way to make it work in terms of the frameworks of how we run our classes and tuition is just what we have to figure out. But we'd absolutely love to have people who want to start working in the sustainability space or already are and want to get deeper knowledge. We want them being a part of this if they can.
Thank you all. Thanks those online and those of you here. And most of all, thank you, Professor Swartley.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you being here.
So I want to thank Dr. Swartley for his excellent presentation and for Dr. Eckstein for her moderation today and helping host us. And also, once again, to Jim Olson and the Johnson County United Nations Association. So it's our honor to present you with the Iowa City Formulations Council mug as a small
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's great.
The beverage of your choice.
Yeah, coffee these days. Lots and lots of coffee. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I want to tell you that our program next week will feature Dr. Peter Gross, who will speak about Russia's persistent disinformation and propaganda war against the West. The program will be held here again next Wednesday. It will also be live streamed by City Channel 4. So thank you for joining us today. We are adjourned.